Hi, welcome to Inside Learning episode 119 for the 3rd of July 2013. Which authority, Matthew? Good evening and welcome to Inside Learning. Welcome, in fact, to the last Inside Learning of this school year. Steve, I hope I've got you on the line there from sunny Nottingham.
You have indeed, and yes, it is sunny.
Wonderful.
I'm bathed in a halo of light here.
Oh, fantastic.
You can tell how angelic I look.
You do look pretty good there, actually. I always think silver hair shades really reflect the sunlight really, you know, particularly well. Yeah, side lighting suits you. And we're joined by a guest who I've been looking forward to having on board the podcast for a very long time. She has finally succumbed to my begging and pleading and encouragement. We have a reasonably newly appointed Director of Education and Other Services at... help me out here. I've blanked. Where the hell is it?
Angus?
Angus Council. Oh dear, the shame. Margot Williamson. Margot, good to have you on board.
Thank you.
So that's a little trick that we use when we pretend that we've forgotten stuff to put our guests at ease.
Matthew likes to give away all our technical secrets.
Dear. So I think we have a bit of sports news tonight. Sometimes we do it and sometimes we don't. We try not to because we've got at least one or two regular listeners that give us hell for this. But Andy Murray's result was pretty good tonight.
It was indeed. And so was Mark Cavendish.
Oh, did Cavendish win a stage?
He did.
Oh, tickety-boo.
Yep.
Magnificent.
Marseille. Yep, indeed.
Margot, yes. do you share any sports predilections?
No, I thought I managed to catch a wee bit of the Murray just at the point where the game began to change and turn. So, it was pretty exciting.
It was impressive. Yeah, I was the same. I missed the first two sets. I just happened to catch on Twitter, as so often happens, that the storm clouds were gathering. So, yeah, he did well. And do you know what I loved about it? It's a funny thing, really, to talk about after such a great piece of sport, but... just that little thing at the net, just that moment when the whole thing's over, the two of them are battled out, and they actually connect at the net. They seem to really like and congratulate each other. And I reflected again about so many football games you see when you get that bitterness and anger. You know, I know it's not always the case. I know you get shirt swaps, but there's something nice about that when it happens in a tennis match, and I think young people watching it probably do get a really decent role model there.
Yeah, and... certainly in terms of resilience and so on. I always think, is Andy Murray's British until he loses in the final when he becomes Scottish, is that right?
Yes. Although I'm always keen to point out that we're maybe a little guilty of that in Scotland as well. We love to point it out when it happens the other way. But hey, I'm delighted that British rider Cav, one of my favourites, has done well. So, yeah, I think it goes both ways.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Right, before Fiona switches off, we better get on with that.
Yeah, sport news over. So tell us a wee bit about your new job then, Margot. What's it like? What's happening?
Well, I'm 12 weeks into my new job. I'm called Strategic Director of People.
Oh, that's good.
Possibly sounds a bit grand, but essentially it's pulling together the functions of social work and education under one director. Previously in Angus, there were six directors, and we've now gone to three strategic directors, and my portfolio is people. There's a strategic director for people and one for communities. So it's quite an exciting time, actually, because as well as a number of national changes, there's significant local change for us, and real opportunities for a whole range of people within the council. And the impression so far is a very, very optimistic, positive one. It's good. People are up for change, enthusiastic about a lot of the things that are coming at us nationally, which don't look really that optimistic to begin with. But, people are willing to adapt and work with them and quite keen to try new things.
Very happy. Margot, can I ask you, when you say that combined role, does that parallel in any way the former children's services in England, you know, with the combination of combine social work and education for children's services. Is that, or is it distinct from that?
No, that's a good point, Steve. Yeah, I mean, it is very much like the children's services role in England. And the only probable difference is I have adults as well.
Right.
You know, I've got adult care, but in Scotland, well, I suppose similarly to England too, actually, we're just at different phases in the process. We're moving towards the integration of health and social care, working very closely with NHS colleagues about how that will look and how that will shape up for the various service users.
Yeah, it's not an easy challenge, though, is it, as the, you know, the number of different services that they integrate under a directorship increase, you know, the difficulty of maintaining your ability to influence them all must be a challenge.
I think fundamentally, though, is, I mean, I really believe in it. I mean, I've come from an authority where I was led by an executive director of children and community. So I know the influence of working very closely without having, well, structures get in the way. And looking at how professionals can work around children and families in a way that, you know, they know who to contact. One person picks things up. One person's their point of contact. And I do think it's actually much better for families, particularly families who are quite vulnerable, to have that kind of service. So because I'm very committed to that approach, I was really enthusiastic about applying for the job. And you know, I really do think it can make a big difference, because so often structures or silos do get in the way of what we're trying to achieve a lot of the time. And I mean, you know what it's like yourself as a service user. Sometimes when you're trying to get a very simple service from a council and you phone up and you have to press 2 or then 4 or you have to talk to one person, well, you're actually not talking to the right person. You need to talk to that person. It can be quite frustrating. So the hope is that through working very closely together, people will get one point of contact, and you know that's the person who will follow them through and give them the support or direct the support from there on.
Mm. Okay, well, that's an optimistic, as you say, view of the world, and you know, hopefully you can get that right, because I think we all get frustrated by, you know, dealing with barriers and silos. But shall we crack on with a couple of news stories and then come back to what we've invited you to talk about, which is developing leadership and the kind of role of leadership in councils, Margot? That'd be okay?
Sure.
Okay, Steve, you brought anything tonight?
Yes, I mean, the big story in England this week was the government's deregulation bill, which I'm not sure entirely what it is in its entirety, but the thing that had the headlines was about the school summer holidays and Michael Gove wanting to give autonomy to head teachers to set their own summer holiday dates, and basically on the basis that, well, for a number of reasons, I think the main one was that learning drops off over the summer, supposedly, and schools ought to have autonomy to be able to set what they think's best for their young people. It strikes me as a couple of issues here. I mean, not necessarily related, but the first issue is the whole thing about deregulation and that tension between local autonomy and system coordination. And the second question is, which I really do have an open mind about, is the structure of our school year. I know we've talked a lot about it, Matthew, in the past, and that everyone says it was tied to the old agricultural model. I mean, again, this is one of those things that I would really like to dig into the history a bit more and see where it did come, you know, where it actually came from. And the other one is, you know, does learning drop off over the summer? Again, an open question. I've never kind of been fully convinced by the evidence that's been presented. On the other hand, having for many families who can't get away and make full use of the break and and face exorbitant costs, childcare costs and holiday costs over, I can see that the 6 week summer holiday may be in need of reform. So again, I've very mixed feelings about it. But as I said, on one hand, there's a political issue about the whole deregulation thing, which I really think needs a kind of huge political discussion. Then the other thing is about, as I say, the content and structure of school terms. So yeah, that was the big story in England this week. I will be ongoing for a while.
Steve, I noticed when reading a similar story, I don't know if it was from the same source, that simultaneously Wales is trying to unify its holidays and actually legislate to just make it a fixed standard one-size-fits-all holiday. So it seemed to contrast quite a lot with the English story.
Yeah, no, it does contrast the English story. I mean, I think one of the arguments against the proposal was that parents, you know, and teachers will all be operating to different timetables and so on. But I'm not sure that that's the biggest objection, because schools are pretty savvy at coordinating on a local level, you know. So I'm sure a kind of group of primaries that are clustered around a secondary or a group of schools in a county are not going to set different holidays, because I know the kind of upset and disruption it causes.
Well, before we bring Margot in this one, Steve, can I tell you that the education authority that our listeners know I work for, our Gell and Butte Council in Scotland out in the West Coast, we have about 70 time zones.
Yeah.
So we're an example of a council that left its own devices has managed to create multiple different holidays. You can pretty much wipe out October because someone somewhere has a holiday in October. And I believe the reason is tradition, you know, that first of all, some of the islands, because we've got 27 inhabited islands, and I think about 10 of them have got schools on them. You know, to come off these islands is often a ferry trip, then a long drive to Glasgow, you know, so people don't just sort of hop on the plane. You know, so they like to have more than just, you know, like long weekends or single day holidays. They're not any good to them. So they gather them all up and they put them into longer block holidays.
Right.
But that doesn't happen uniformly across the whole zone. So, you know, you've got to picture the scene in Argyll and Butte Education HQ. It's like a James Bond film set, you know, and there's the director sitting stroking the cat, you know, and there are 15 clocks along the wall with a big sine wave under it, you know, as the sun sets across Mull, you know. It's like Soviet Russia, 63. You know?
Yeah.
So to be serious, though, we can't even coordinate one set of holidays because there are genuine practical reasons,
right?
You know, why people can make a case that it should be different. So, Margot, bringing you in there, have you thoughts and experiences with this?
I mean, in some ways, I mean, you do feel that it's important for head teachers to have autonomy, and the community and the context within which they work is significant and really important, because we've got very different communities. But there comes a point around about what's the systems here, and what you're trying to deliver and how you're trying to operate. And I think fundamentally what has to happen is there's proper engagement with people around what's realistic, because often you have families who have children at a range of schools, and you do have different holiday arrangements and different sequences for that, and how do you cater for that? So although it sounds like an ideal opportunity for a bit more autonomy, if you don't have collaboration around the number of schools within the same area, you could actually have something that is really pretty chaotic and people unsure when the school's open, when it's closed, because they've been talking to their neighbour whose children goes to a different school. So much of it's laudable, but practically, I'm not sure how it could possibly work.
Yeah, no, I think that's some of the biggest objections are around that. But I heard Anthony Seddon, well, just caught the end of Anthony Seddon on the radio. As you know, he's the head of Wellington School. And obviously written a number of quite interesting books. I mean, his one on Blair was fascinating. But saying that how important the long holiday was, I mean, the independent schools have hugely long holidays. But then I was thinking, well, that's all right for his kids, isn't it? Because their parents will take them skiing or sailing or
pony club
or what have you. But the average British parent is probably tearing their hair out, you know, for 6 weeks. I don't know. It's difficult. I mean, there is a point at which you want young people to sort of do something completely different. I mean, which is one of the reasons why we started the summer school programs, you know, and which were to be very unlike school, but young people would be learning without realising they were learning.
This is when you were director of the UFA in England, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, summer schools.
That's right. And the whole point of those summer schools were for kids who would actually otherwise do nothing in the holiday but hang around or hang out. I mean, another point is actually sometimes it's good to be bored, isn't it? I mean, it teaches us a lot about life. So I said, I've got very mixed feelings about this. I think there is a need for some rethinking of school timetables, but I've got to be wary of, we're on an exam treadmill in England where kids are just getting fed up with being pressured all the time. So we've got to be very wary about what we substitute, you know, the structures with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's again a very, very good point, Steve. I mean, I do like the idea of young people having an alternative to schooling, if schooling's really about academia and sitting at desks. And I suppose what we need to think much more autonomously is round about, well, what else do we offer? What offers that outdoor education experience, or, you know, team game spirit, citizenship, that kind of thing? And You know, perhaps, it's just as you've obviously done, is providing opportunities for young people that don't have privileged backgrounds to be going abroad or doing something with their parents, but allowing them the opportunities to come and use our leisure facilities and sporting activities and out with school learning activities that probably will stand them in very good stead for the future. I mean, one of the things I feel that with young people more and more, as the technological revolution takes hold, if we could call it that, is they will have to have a much stronger awareness of themselves and what they like doing and what they enjoy doing and what they can do when they're out of work, and possibly intermittently, but in some cases maybe for a lot longer than any of us ever were. And it's these talents and interest in the outdoors or running or swimming or maybe going to the theatre or the ballet, as you were saying that your son's involved in, that really will support them with their mental health and just lifelong pleasure as they grow up.
Yeah, Mark, I think that gets to the heart of the big challenge. I was trying to think, as you said, you know, what's the point of this? I'm not sure what your phrasing was, but it was, what are we trying to achieve with the system of holidays and the timing? And actually, it's hard to just nail the primary objective, isn't it? What's the thing we're really trying to do? And I think you're getting close to it there. It's about, you know, remembering that the school system is for preparing young people for a complex life, which will have more or less uniform jobs, but options for young people to, you know, to choose from those different things. And it seems to me that what we're doing is we're trying to solve it with a systems approach rather than gradually evolving towards having young people in charge of these decisions. So Brian Boyd, I think when he was a guest on this cast, Keep Me Right, Steve, I'm pretty sure it was him, said, why don't we just move towards the kind of holidays that people get in non-teaching jobs? You know, the parents and the family could say, well, we're going to take those 3 or 4 weeks. You know, and actually the fact that the system can't accommodate that is understandable, but it's also a sign that the system doesn't yet in any way resemble real life and real choices.
Yeah, but it can't, can it, in some ways? I mean, like, we're not in a factory producing stuff, you know, like, or...
No, but it could. If someone came to the three of us tonight and said, look, in some bizarre set of circumstances, we're asking you just to redesign the whole school system, you know, stop all of the systems, you know, restaff the schools, begin the whole thing afresh, you probably wouldn't design in a summer exam diet, would you? You would perhaps allow the new system had learning planning, guidance, learning advisors, youngsters following a course that sometimes had them in classes, you know, by need and by, you know, by academic level and interest and stream sort of thing. I mean, career stream, and occasionally working on their own, you know, online doing exam, and passing out when they're ready. It might be in April of, you know, of their 12th year of school. I know what I want to do now. I'm ready to go into this university, this training initiative or whatever, and I've got the set of qualifications I need. I gathered half of them over the last 3 years, you know, throughout different months of the year. But that's not the way we've designed the system. And that's what throws up odd questions like this that are kind of paradoxical, that, you know, we think we're trying to do something to make the system better for learning, but actually I think we would agree that it's not about the learning anymore, it's about making the system fit the lives that people have got, which in a rather circular way have come from the school that they work around anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I would love to be able to say that in about three sentences, because that's all that there was content-wise in that. I do beg your pudding.
My previous boss, who didn't come from an educational background, and was always challenging me about the way things schools were, the way schools were, and you know, he said to me, "Why do you keep going on about the attendance figures all the time?" Well, I mean, we're measured on, you know, how many children attend school for how long, and you know, that's monitored by Scottish Government, was my reply. He says, well, I want us, this was the local authority, I want us to build in 2 weeks for the parents to make their choices about when they want to take their children off school. again, you know, a laudable idea. But I began to think about this and I thought, well, if parents start to take their young people off school 2 weeks before the end of term or 2 weeks into August when the school started, what would happen? And one of the things that really used to irritate me when I was head of education was we used to send out letters to parents to say, well, you're taking your child off school 3 days before the end of term or whatever, and this is against X legislation, blah, 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 you know, the kind of thing. Yeah. But occasionally I would go around schools in the last few days of term and I'd think, what's going on here? You know, what kind of learning is taking place? And yet we send out these letters. And it was a real dichotomy for me, because what he was suggesting was a good thing to suggest, and yet we were being measured by the amount of openings, the amount of days that young people were in school. But were we giving them the best quality of education every single day up until they came off on holiday? I would have to say probably not.
I'm sure you're right. I mean, most of us that have visited schools in the last week of term before summer are, you know, seeing quite a lot of videos being watched and quite a lot of downtime, you know, that indicates that the content of the year was always possible. I'm not saying to our teaching colleagues that it would ever be easy, but clearly it's been possible to squish it into less than the planned time.
So my point is, if we were to begin to allow that level of flexibility that he was suggesting, which, again, I couldn't disagree with, would that happen even earlier? Because, oh, well, there's only half the class here and there are too many losing out on learning to start something new. So it's the issues it creates for other young people if we build in more autonomy to the system. That's worth considering thoroughly.
I think you're absolutely right. And the key word there was the class, you know, because the unit of learning is still the class, not the individual child who's got a plan. Anyway, I'll tell you what, I'll just throw in my story now because it's entirely linked. I was agonising about a couple of choices there, but you've helped me swing to this one. Call to let school pupils stay in bed an extra hour. I think you can see the link here. There's a councillor in Glasgow, Dr. Nina Baker, who has cited academic research that backs her belief that there are benefits in letting children start any time up to 10 o'clock if they wish, especially focusing on teenagers as opposed to younger pupils, which is an odd thing. But she's claiming that teenagers as opposed to young primary pupils tend to do better if they start at 10 a.m. And in fact, there was a school 2009-2010 in this piece in the Herald, which was called Monk Seton High in North Tyneside. Never heard of them, I have to say. You might know of them, Steve.
Found that
after starting lessons from 10 a.m. instead of 9, general absence has dropped by 8%. These are just bits and bytes, these, and persistent absenteeism by 27%. It also mentions UCL Academy in London became the first school to introduce a 10 a.m. start for its sixth form. And they found that they perform better when 16 to 18 year olds start later in the morning. Anyway, on it goes. There's a, you know, comments from an Eastern Bartonshire head teacher basically poo-pooing it and saying that he's never seen any difference whether they start earlier or later. And the other fascinating thing is that there are comments on the website and that the Herald, with people, quite reactionary comments, pretty much saying, well, you know, the real world's waiting for them. They just damn well have to get up when they're supposed to get up. You know? there are no comments that are positive about it, although only a small sample of comments. So I just wonder what you thought of that. Do you know, does this link? You know, is this idea of individualization again? If you've got to be with your class at nine, well, you've got to be with your class at nine. If, on the other hand, you could start at 10 and you finish your school day at 5, if that suits you, and you get the work done that you and your learning advisory team have, you know, have arranged for you, what difference does it make? And increasingly in the future, what will real work look like, you know? Mm. There is a final question that arises for me in this, which is a genetic one. I know that people like Steven Pinker, you know, have always argued that there's genetic evidence that a small percentage of a population always had to be, you know, regardless of teenage or not, but just a small percentage would always tend to be night owls, because when you think back to our hunter-gatherer past again, you know, the idea that somehow when sundown came that every member of your population would all fall fast asleep exhausted would make you very vulnerable as a nomadic population. So it was probably one of these advantages like left-handedness, you know, to be a night owl that actually does well only because it's a minority. So is there a little kind of a... Is there a little equality issue there that we might actually have some children that are genetically predisposed to be, you know, slightly more night owlish? Interesting. Lots of questions there. And they all point to the same thing as the last question, the last story, which is how individual is our system?
Sorry, forgive me laughing. I do love these evolutionary biologists, because there's no way you can falsify or verify that claim, is there? But, I mean, you know, it does make some sort of logical sense. I mean, they certainly in the States have done a lot of work on teenage sleep deprivation. A number of United States schools have tried different starting times, and I'm not fully versed in the evidence, but what I've seen in the research, it is mixed. Mm. You know, some people do claim huge results for it. Others, like the one critic, are poo-pooing it. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, there's so many motivational factors go into these things, isn't there? It's difficult to sort the variables out. But coming back to your main point, which I think is the fundamental thing, is and the question you asked about the last item was really about the purposes of education. You know, what are the purposes? What are we trying to do with learning and education? And therefore, how does that then dictate the system? And I think your point was, and quite rightly, that it's the system's sort of convenience that's driving, you know, we've got the thing the wrong way around, haven't we? Is what you're saying. And I kind of agree with you, and that this is another case where we might, you know, if you thought about individualizing it, and certainly might say, well, actually some, you know, you might look at sort of peak learning times, but then, you know, have critics got it, you know, what are we preparing children for?
Well, there's one humorous angle in this, which comes from the comments on this article in the Herald. One reactionary says, how does this ready kids work? That this is just mistyped. But how does this ready kids for work, I think is missing, for the real world of work that often begins at 8? And someone has answered afterwards saying, it would be fine for the back shift. Which I rather like. But I'd love to bring you in there, Margot, because same. I've read a few of your tweets, and I believe I've noted to you directly before that it's almost Napoleonic levels of unhealthiness that you often send them at 6 a.m.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I am quite an early person. I don't know. I suppose I draw on myself as a mother here, and having brought up a number of teenagers who.
Well, you realise all the listeners now imagine that you've got 17 of them.
Who will stay in bed?
Is this a smaller number than that? Yeah. Sorry.
I would never reject any research that people do, because it does take a lot of work to put in proper research, and you know, the results showed particular things. Am I sceptical about it? Yeah, probably. I mean, some successful education systems are producing young people who are up very early and involved in education. I suppose, again, for me, you know, I worked in the university where, you know, we were taking people straight from school who'd been used to a 9 to 3.30 day, and suddenly they had classes that did begin at 9, but, you know, they could go on to much later in the day, and there were parts of the day when they weren't in and they were doing other things. And I suppose what I would like to see is the is the school day expanding, but not necessarily all for academic teaching activity, you know, other kinds of activity that could be going on. So, you know, like the school of football that runs in a number of parts of the country where young people come in and, you know, do sports before they actually start what we would term really as their normal school day. But it's that flexibility and more opportunities and choice that gets me quite excited. I'm just not convinced that starting at 10 would make a huge difference. There is a more conservative part probably about me and my thinking around this too, about routine. I would hesitate to call it work ethic, but you know, the importance of general low-lying discipline of yourself to be work ready, education ready at a certain time, and organised for that. Now, if that's at 8:30, 7:30, 9:30, or 10:30, that's still the way we would want it to be. Does the time make such a significant difference, given we live in a country that has seasons and very different times of the year, different forms of light and things like that? I'm just not sure.
Oh, a diplomatic, if moderately stentorian answer there, Margot, I would say. Okay, well, shall we move on? These have been interesting conversations all around the theme of variance, and I think they're quite opposite to, you know, to the long summer holiday now stretching out in front of our Scottish kids, and obviously just about to start for our English youngsters. But one other thing just to pick up on there, Margot, you were saying you taught in university. Our listeners might not be aware about where that was.
In Dundee.
Okay, what did you do there?
I was a senior lecturer in education in Dundee. Did you not know that, Matthew?
I'm just wanting our listeners to know that as well, Margot, that's all. You're presuming because I forgot the name of Angus Council, I'd forgotten that too. Actually, our listeners, though, you know, many of whom are probably in England and elsewhere, Margot, might be interested to know that Angus is in the East Coast and above Dundee. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it stretches from Monifieth all the way up to Montrose towards Stonehaven, which is in Aberdeenshire. It's a lovely part of the world, actually. It's got beautiful mountains and also a lovely coastline.
Mm. Yeah, it's a stunning place, absolutely stunning.
And if you like golf, which I don't really, championship golf courses. So, yeah, it's a lovely place to work. And live, so I'm very privileged to be in the role.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go back to that then. I know we touched on it at the start. We'd hoped to have a little bit of a conversation around the role of leadership. You know, in Scotland, for example, we've got these 32 authorities. I don't know quite how many there are in England, Steve. Do you know how many overall?
It's 100. I can't remember, it's something like 133, 153, somewhere around that. I don't know why somewhere around 150 springs to mind, though.
With that ballpark, though, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, though, when you go to different authorities, you know, I mean, I used to do it as a consultant, visiting lots of different places, you know, doing training. You really get a flavour that people say, you know, the new boss, the new director or whatever has made a difference, either positively or negatively, you know, and I guess that's something that must be very much in your mind just now, Margot, is, you know, why is that, you know, or is it real, you know, do we just attribute change to a figurehead because that's convenient, you know, when the change might have been happening anyway, you know? So what's your view, Margot, of just how much of a difference a leader makes in local education management?
I think a leader can make a significant difference. I think you've got to be very much aware of what it is you do and what it is you influence. It's a very different job. I mean, I don't have day-to-day control over what happens in every classroom around the authority, but I do have key responsibility for directing the way I want particular things to happen for the children within that authority. And I suppose the biggest role for me is to ensure that not only do I lead and champion that message, but I'm out there communicating it and building relationships with people. So they believe what I'm saying and also see how important it is to deliver that. So there's a bit of influencing and supporting and, I suppose in some ways, coaching people to say, this is what will make the difference. And if I get that right, then I would say that as a leader, I will have been successful. So I think the leader, and we know this even from schools that are successful or social work services that are successful, where there is somebody who is really committed to making a difference to children's lives at the top, mm-hmm. these children's lives will change.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mark, I've got two thoughts that popped unbidden into my mind there while you were speaking. One is there is a challenge, isn't there, for leaders in big organisations about that kind of distance. You know, you're saying, you know, a leader like yourself doesn't necessarily, and I don't want to necessarily focus around you. I know we're just trying to have a general conversation. I don't want to put you in the spot. But a leader of a big authority doesn't influence, you know, what happens in a classroom directly tomorrow. I mean, maybe you do, but it's not really the situation you've described. And there's also a kind of a PR aspect to what you just described, you know, that not only is it difficult for senior leaders to kind of have reach going into different different areas of the service and classrooms or other parts of the service, but there's something about the really successful ones being good at having a voice that reaches widely, you know, and it's more about marketing and PR than it is about direct leadership. I don't even know what I'm saying, but those are the two things I grabbed from what you just said.
Yeah, I think it's also how you build the relationships with people. The people who will deliver and develop the message that you're putting out. And I suppose in some ways that depends on how you see the authority. Is it a machine? Hmm. Is it an organism? Is it an unfolding story? What is it? And I think a significant role is to empower people to try things, support each other. For me to be there should they fall. But, you know, it's understanding the complexity of what you're dealing with. But probably all the time looking out for who are the disciples, who also understands that what we are here for every day is to make a difference to people's lives. So, yeah, I mean, I take your point about the PR bit, but communication, relationships, and probably helping people see that working in particular ways can, through an evidence base, improve what we're currently doing with young people. And I suppose being sound about that research base or that evidence base and the implications of carrying out things in particular ways makes that difference.
Can I just ask, Margot, you know, you talked about building relationships and obviously finding key people. I suppose you made a conscious decision in terms of building relationships with those that are easy wins, if you see what I mean, to start with. Tim Brighouse used to talk about, you know, working with the energy givers rather than the energy drainers to start with. I mean, or do you go out of your way to kind of to try and build relationships with those people who are most challenging to your? I mean, where do you kind of start on this, or is it a bit of everything?
I think probably, you know, the first adopters, you know, the enthusiasts are easy to work with. But Zander also talks about, you know, getting on the balcony and dancing with the ugly people. I love that phrase.
That's lovely.
I have to say, yeah. As one of them, I find it a comforting phrase.
Excellent.
Sorry, carry on.
In lots of ways, it's easy to dance with the beautiful people, isn't it? But yeah. If you're going to make a difference, you also have to learn to dance with the ugly people. I have to say this, not that we have any in Angus.
How diplomatic.
But I suppose one of the other big attributes of a great leader is the storytelling, and it's how What is it that gets some of the resistors to change, beginning to think, actually, this might work. I might just give that a wee try. You know, and it's that ability to begin to connect with people, to just take them, in some cases, a very, very short way that then releases them to say, actually, this is great. This is I'm going to go for it even more. In order for really to begin to develop into a critical mass.
Right. So, sorry, Matthew, can I just follow this thread?
Please do, yeah.
Because it just then springs to mind, you see, I mean, I really like that phrase, Dancing with the Ugly People. That's going to think it happened to be our episode title. What I'm thinking here is you're describing a very, if you like, ethical approach to being with people.
Yeah.
And what's happened in particularly in England with the kind of politicization of leadership, it's about the doing bit, you know what I mean? The kind of the focus on doing in a certain way rather than being in a certain way. And I think you've described something that's, and it could be down to your personality, to your wisdom, to your experience, but is it something that can be trained up and taught and passed on? That kind of ability to think in that way or make those connections?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think that is so difficult. I think the challenging aspect of that is being confident enough to take the cynic or the most difficult person in your team into your group to have them as part of your group, because actually they're the ones that will actually probably take you further on than your allies in lots of ways. Because you've got to remember that when you're in a senior position, you also carry this authority, and some people follow you because you have authority rather than because you actually have leadership.
Right.
You know, it's a deference thing, and you've got to be aware that there is a sense in some places about the fact that you do have a badge of authority, and there will be a red carpet in front of you in fresh paint.
Well, so, Margaret, that's probably a good time to remind you of last week's episode title, which was "I for One Welcome Our New Leaders." Sorry, it's just got that spirit about it, hasn't it? It was tongue in cheek, yeah, but it's exactly that. Sorry, carry on.
So, you know, working with the ugly people or the cynics or the critics or whatever, and bringing them into the centre is a really important thing to do, because they will ask questions that perhaps your what appear to be your most sincere followers won't ask. And it's sometimes these questions that develop you as a person and also help you get to the place that you need to get to with meaning, rather than just because you as the leader said it's the thing to do.
Yeah. Steve, were you still following that through? Because I'd grabbed something from what Margaret was saying as well there.
Yeah, go on.
You made
Steve,
a link.
Have you given up on me?
No. I'm just digesting that. I suppose I'm coming back to the political element that, so for example, so much was invested in the National College of School Leadership in England, you know, and about training the next generation of leaders and how leaders are important. But it's part of it to me, I mean, they do some good stuff in there, but part of it to me is a very narrow vision of doing leadership, you know, which is kind of tied to a very political, very utilitarian, and what you were describing earlier was a much more profound and richer sense of being. Do you see what I mean? And I just wonder whether sometimes the kind of whole leadership things become a bit toxic.
You mentioned that last week, Steve. This is obviously in your mind just now.
Is it something that is multidimensional, and sometimes people just take one of these dimensions and not really have either an awareness or enough consideration to the other aspects of it? So what looks like quite a simple thing to do is ignoring some of the complexities that are associated with it.
Yeah. And the kind of transportation of models from one sector of society to another, for example. Well, it worked in business a few years back, so it ought to work here, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, that that somehow we can pass on a technical mantra and it'll all be all right because we've got great, you know, we've trained all these leaders. Whereas what you were describing, you know, the kind of dancing with the ugly people strikes me as a whole, is very much more difficult and complex thing, which, yeah, maybe you can teach people, but actually there's something about the way that they are, the way that they're being with people, do you see what I mean? Which, about wisdom, which is, strikes me as something very, a different kind of relationship. I don't know.
I know I'm very aware of the fact that I have responsibility for a professional workforce. Now, I mean, the people who work with me are all professionals. It's a degree workforce. And I think you've got to start with the premise that these people came into teaching or into social work to make a difference. And I think respecting what they bring, even if somewhere along the way they've begun to think differently or do things differently, helps to bring them back to why they came into the role a lot of the time. Now, I don't know if in business that's the same, because, you know, a lot of the time it's a very different workforce and the focus all the time is on, well, maybe I'm being a bit harsh here, profits, but, you know, the respecting of the workforce, the valuing of the workforce, or building value within the workforce, I think helps achieve the goals too. So I always come at it from that perspective.
Sorry, Matthew, you pick it up.
I just wanted to pick up one of both of your points, actually, and that's that you mentioned Tim Brickhouse, Steve, who is an interesting example of a leader of a big authority which had real challenges that it did seem to make a difference. Now, I think that's a naive thing to say, even as I say it, you know, because I know that I went to lots of Birmingham schools, even as a Scot coming to do work there, and heard a variety of opinions from he's a complete idiot leading us into madness to, you know, the kind of middle ground, which is, oh my God, he's had a vision again, you know, let's all run around and pick it up, to the probably the large minority who would say, it's good that we've got someone batting for us, you know, that this is a guy who really cares and seems to get us and at least tells our story effectively. And that was my link, because Marco, you used the word story in something you said a wee while ago, that part of your leadership thing was telling a story. That's a theme through a lot of Brickhouse's writing, that a leader tells the story of the team, by which I'm sure he means the authority when you scale it up, you know, that... just how consciously do you do that? You know, that you realize that people don't learn through documents and you know, hidden stuff in folders. It's through shared stories.
Yeah, last week I was at ADSW, the Associate Directors of Social Work, and the guy Gavin Esler from BBC. Yeah. He spoke. I don't know if have you ever heard him?
Yeah.
Only on the news.
He used three questions. It was a bit like Norman Drummond does, actually, but they're slightly different questions. Who am I, which is a similar one to how Norman starts his work. Who are we, as in the group, the leadership group, and where will my leadership take us? And he talked about, you know, good leaders, and he used a number of examples, and how they tell their story in this way. And that's what develops the team and takes them forward with a shared vision and a shared collection of outcomes. I thought that was quite an interesting one. I then tried it on my team. I did actually say I was stealing it from him.
And did you find it? I mean, did people consciously engage with you, or did you just try it without telling them what you were doing?
No, I told them I told them that these were the three questions and this is how I was going to frame my presentation. The feedback afterwards was very, very positive. And interestingly enough, it was to do with some of the authenticity and the personal stuff that I'd woven through it. So people do like to know a wee bit about why do you think that's important and what is it in your social heritage that's led you to think that this is the way we should be operating. So I do think there is something in the storytelling and the authenticity of what we're trying to do that comes through and connects with people.
Margot, can I ask a wee question? Attached to that in my mind, and I'm going to confess to any listeners here, it's a hobby horse of mine at the moment. Is there a danger that we have a storytelling culture with our best leaders who tell the story of our learning and our improvement as an education or a, for that matter, social work service, but that our documents and our systems don't mirror that? You know, so in other words, you know, you go and you tell great tales about your three or four best service stories, and you galvanise people with that, and you subtly transmit the values of your organisation through that. But that we actually still gauge, no, we don't gauge, sorry, we still expect that schools and teams will report through a kind of a grid format that's not a readable format, if you know what I mean. It's more about, sort of project planning than it is about telling a story. Is there a danger we get a disjoint between systems and great leadership?
Yeah, I think that's a very relevant point, Matthew. I think there is opportunities for people to tell the story of the authority, and then what actually is the authority and what is the nature of the story they're telling. I think significantly it's important to be connecting with the people, as I said earlier on, but also frequently engaging with frontline service, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a home care worker. What is it like for you? Tell me what it is you do. What is the process that you go through on a daily basis? So that if you are telling the story and you're at some sort of high branch in a tree, that you're actually telling the story as it is rather than how you think it is, from the people who are immediately connected to you, which often are the people who will tell you what you want to hear. So it's that helicopter idea about really drilling down into the organisation, being on the front line as much as you possibly can, and engaging with the people who are actually delivering the services, so that any story you're telling or any process you're developing has fully been tested by the people who will impact on the most.
Mm. Steve, can I slip in one final brief question here? I know that you've got. I can see Steve's video here. You see Margot, and he's got his thoughtful face on. I know he's about to come in here, but I've as you know, been going for new roles myself in the system, Margot, and on the grapevine, I've been hearing that the quality of people who are going for senior roles in education just now. Sorry, that's not what I'm trying to say. That the number of applicants of quality that are going for senior roles is difficult, you know. So if you're looking to advertise a role like, you know, a director or a head of service or a senior, you know, service manager or whatever, you might like to be able to interview 10 people or 6 people, you know, that's not what's happening. That actually increasingly are struggling to get more than 3 or 4 people of the calibre. And my question really for all of us is just, how well are we developing future leaders, you know, with the systems that we've got just now in the last decade of inspectorial kind of approach, whereby there's a right way to do things? And, you know, is there a danger we're developing people that are good at admin rather than good at leadership? A whole lot of linked questions there in my mind.
Sorry, I thought you were asking Steve. Do you want Steve to go first?
Either one of you, to be honest. Yeah, I just did one of my tumbleweed questions again. Yes, there. But inside learning listeners haven't even worried about that. They took that in their stride, whereas unfortunate guests aren't ready for that. Sorry, Margot. Either of you.
Margot, you answer because you're the guest here.
Okay. The Strategic Leadership Development Programme that was started a couple of years ago through Virtual Staff College in IDES in Scotland.
It's probably obvious to our listeners outside Scotland, but that's the Association of Directors of Education in Scotland.
Yeah. I thought the programme they designed was a really good programme, which built in 360 coaching and mentoring and, you know, and a number of other activities. And the thing that I got the most out of, I was asked to be a coach working with 5 senior managers across Scotland, coaching them and working with them as a team. And it was very much focused on leadership and not about process and not about management. So I do actually think there are opportunities out there that don't just do a process measurement type tick box and that's you now a leader approach, and that would be one that I would really highly recommend in Scotland anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly I didn't mean to baldly criticise her. I guess I was just wondering whether our system is producing the kind of leaders that we need for the future. And are we, am I wrong in fearing that we're not producing enough future leaders at the moment and that we're having a bit of a problem with that?
I mean, I'm not aware of what the picture is across the country as far as recruitment's concerned. But I think probably different authorities are taking different approaches with that as well. Certainly my last authority, we did a lot of work about succession leadership and succession planning for a whole range of groups because we could see the demographic was beginning to shift and it may impact on us later. And we thought, well, we need to begin to grow our own and we want a values-based leadership approach to the people we want to put in these roles. So I guess a number of other authorities will be taking that approach. And of course, we've now got the beginnings of a leadership college within Scotland, have we not, that are currently housed in Education Scotland?
Yeah, it certainly looks as if there are talks about it, and it looks like there's a real, firm commitment now to birthing this thing. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing that's associated with that, and I know you and I chatted for a few minutes just before we started the podcast, is, do we think at senior levels in education that we want people who lead, with a focus on the values side of that and the people side of that, but because of the sheer complexity of education authority work, whereby accountability is huge, you want to lead with education stories, but you end up leading through, complaints management and reporting of statistics. Is there a danger that we've got a rhetoric that we genuinely and with integrity believe and try and act out, but that the systems of education authorities drag us back to looking for good administrators anyway because they don't drop the ball?
For me, fundamentally, leadership's about results. You'll get these results in different ways. If you demonstrate outcomes, if you're looking for the outcomes, and some of the outcomes we're measured on are good outcomes, fundamentally, it's about making sure that the outcomes you're getting for the young people are better than they were before and are they the right ones. So I don't really see them as opposite ends of a pole. I think leadership fundamentally is about getting results. It's making that difference.
Steve, before I go further down this rat hole, do you want to take us a different direction? I know a rat hole when I see one.
And if you're like one of those gophers, you're just peering out of the... is it safe to come up yet?
Exactly. No, I realise them. I have the sense, Margo, that there is something going on because I know I've been told recently that either it's been difficult to form a list to make appointments or that people haven't appointed at a senior level. So I have a suspicion, through my recent experiences of looking for posts that... that something interesting is going on. But I'll be quite truthful and say, I think our little conversation showing I'm not sure what it is. So I found that helpful, but I think I have to go and reflect on what I've just learned from that conversation.
If anything, yes.
I don't know what the situation is in England. All I know is that the role of local authorities is becoming so complex and squeezed. I don't know what kind of a leadership in a local authority role looks like anymore. I'm really out of touch there. I suppose one of the questions is the kind of competing values, or are the competing values between central government trying to have quick wins and leverage out change in a system and at the same time devolve more autonomy to the system? I get the feeling that middle tier that used to be so important in supporting schools at the local level somehow has been squeezed out between those competing values of governance. And I don't know where it's going. I guess that leaders of local authorities are in increasingly difficult positions. I suppose my question to you, Margo, is, do you recognise those kind of pools in governance in your work?
again, I'm not quite sure how to compare the Scottish system to England, because I know there are differences. I think in Scotland we've now got quite streamlined central teams, and some authorities might even be anorexic. A lot of the responsibility rests with the head teacher. And again, I think the feedback from that is very positive in some respects, and sometimes this is a bit too much, that everything stops with me. So I suppose a lot of it comes down to what are the kind of leaders we want leading our schools and what is expected of them. I suppose the central team in Scotland of an authority now is much more the interface with the elected members and the politicians in supporting schools with aspects locally, and also the national agenda that comes from the national politics. But leadership of the school, the education, the learning rests, and the curriculum development rests with the head teacher and the senior leadership teams.
So that's interesting, Margo. Yeah, and actually, what you've just done there, Margo, has reminded me of something I often forget, because when Steve and I and our various wonderful guests talk about the learning across the border, you know, the Scottish and English system, on the face of it seem very different. But that bit actually is quite similar. You know, the whole move towards academies and free schools in England and that autonomy, actually, in terms of curriculum for excellence, is reflected here, isn't it? That you know, we increasingly devolve the leadership of learning and the decision making about learning, even the design of the curriculum within loose frameworks, to Scottish schools. So you've just made a connection for me that should have been obvious, but I think I'd let slip.
So I suppose the revised guidelines for devolved school management made that quite clear about how much of the resource and responsibility should be devolved to schools.
Yeah, and it's a lot.
Yeah.
So it goes back to the role of the senior leader in an education authority as being, you know, building relationships, working with people, doing these dances that you've you've talked about, and building a sense of a shared story, you know, so that the people are leading in those schools lead towards the same inspired story, or within the same inspired story. I think for me that's a key question tonight. Is it toward or within? I'm not sure.
I think you put your finger on a really important point there, Matthew, because we've never really bottom out in this education conversation whether autonomy and to what degree autonomy is a good thing is actually going to improve education, because the current drive in England is the assumption that, well, if you give schools autonomy and you give communities autonomy, then it's going to drive up standards, it's going to produce a better system. But we've never really had a thoroughgoing discussion about to what degree, what scope, what does autonomy look like, how do you coordinate, the holiday news story was an example, you know, just at that level. So I think people, you know, like yourself, Margot, are absolutely vital elements in the system, but I'm not sure in England how well treated they've been.
Okay, well, we've just hit the back of an hour, and I guess that pretty much makes an episode of Inside Learning. So, Margot, before we wrap up, because we could talk about this for forever, and I suppose I have one brief question that was burning, I can't help it, which is a rhetorical one. Is authority a good word anymore for local education, you know, services? But I think we'll leave that with the listener rather than press anyone to answer it. Because it doesn't seem to match the kind of language about, you know, building relationships and working with people that you've talked about. You know, the word itself is old-fashioned, I think.
Absolutely. As is rector, and I keep coming across rectors. Rulers. Is that a good word? Yeah, I mean, I love words, and I totally agree, Matthew. We need to have a wee think about some of the terminology we use.
I think so, absolutely. But anyway, this has been a very, very rich conversation. Margot, I've got a real sense it was sprung lots of stuff on you, not deliberately, because it's just been a genuinely unscripted, just relaxed conversation with leadership. But let's let you have a bit of fun to close us off. Obviously, you have massive power. I mean, clearly, you know, you sit on a throne at home. You probably have a bed with a golden, you know, golden four poster kind of number, you know, going on, you know, and a scepter by it. But if you had that kind of real power or authority, what playful thing would you change? I'm thinking about David Cameron and others' Festival of Dangerous Ideas. You know, what 10 years in the future would you maybe like to see happening?
Well, I hate to be boring, but I go back to we can and must do better. We're still not doing what we should be doing for our looked after children and our most vulnerable. And I guess, again, that's why I feel I'm in the right place for with this job, because some of our young people are still not getting the deal that they should be getting from the services we deliver. So what I would change is try to improve that significantly.
In the sense of that individualisation, that you know, to make it really mean something for the youngsters that the system doesn't serve well at the moment?
Absolutely. How do we give them the leg up that a lot of other children get automatically? How do we do it? How do we crack that?
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, it's dangerously close to the American No Child Left Behind, isn't it? If only we could get that right, because it was a good phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for it's been corrupted, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, as so many things are. And Margot, one final thing before I let Steve close off for us here. Margot, how do listeners that have enjoyed virtually meeting you, because I can vouch for it, I've met you a few times. In fact, you came to our authority to do some work recently, and I hope you won't mind me saying live and online, you know, I found you a fabulous educator, you know, with real ideas, and you're that rare thing, a practical intellectual in our business, you know. I think it's been great. But how do other listeners find you online and you know, get a little share of you?
I mean, I really welcome interactions with anybody and communication. I'm on email and I'm also on Twitter, and I'm easy to find because I'm just under my name. I've not got anything strange.
Okay, so do a search on Twitter, Margot Williamson, and people can have a wee bit of engagement with you. And I certainly encourage listeners to do so, because, you know, as I say, you're a very thoughtful person and very, very knowledgeable. Wise, dare I say? Steve, closing thoughts to your good self.
No, I just enjoyed a hugely rich conversation. I know we've probably gone on for a long time and could have gone on longer. So thank you, Margot. And I think one of the things I take away certainly is your ability to think about the relationships and the values, the ethical dimensions of, as I say, being with the people you work and the stories you tell. So thank you for a really rich conversation tonight. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, well, thanks everyone, and we are taking our summer break now. Steve and I, of course, those of you know us, will not be surprised to hear are disorganised enough not to know the actual restart date, but it'll be on our website after we have our 10-minute after the podcast conversation tonight. So look at insidelearning.net and you'll find that stuff out, but we'll be back in August sometime. So everyone, thank you for listening. Thank you for all the support you've given the podcast throughout this year. Hopefully conversations have been enriching, and just have a great well-earned break. Thank you and good night.
Thank you. Good night.